I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a left-leaning Israeli kibbutznik invites a right-wing settler to relocate to the kibbutz. But first, tens of thousands of Italians paid their respects in Rome today to the Italian intelligence agent who was killed by U.S. soldiers in Iraq on Friday, just after he negotiated the release of Italian journalist Giuliana Screna. Screna says that the car that they were in wasn't going very fast as it drove the notoriously dangerous road to the Baghdad airport, and they were not warned before coming under fire from U.S. troops.
A tank started to shoot to us without any sign or any light. It was not a checkpoint, so I can't explain it. But I think that we have to explain it because it's not normal.
Screna also says she may have been deliberately targeted, a charge the Bush administration says is absurd. But the incident has heightened anti-war sentiment in Italy, where officials are weighing a murder investigation, and it's also renewed questions about the safety of U.S. checkpoints in Iraq. Joining us on the line is Tracy Wilkinson, Rome bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. And Tracy, what are Italians saying? The war in Iraq is unpopular there, even though Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi sent troops to Iraq and is one of President Bush's strongest allies.
Italians are angry and baffled. They want answers. They can't understand how this could have happened. They've heard the allegations that Screna has made. They want to know what happened. They want a real, true, deep investigation and an explanation.
Well, one of the things she has said is that she believes she might have been targeted, in particular because there might have been a ransom paid for Giuliana Screna. Do we know that?
Well, it has been rumored for some time involving earlier hostages as well. You might remember the two Italian aid workers, women aid workers, who were held for a couple of weeks and then released. Then it came up, and it's come up before, that the Italians might have paid ransoms of a lot of money. We're talking a couple million dollars in some cases, according to the rumors. One minister here has said that it's probably true, but again, we don't have that confirmed. The government officially has denied it in the past, is not saying anything right now about this particular case. Screna's allegation is that she might have been targeted because the United States disapproves of the policy of paying.
In fact, she says that her captors warned her that Americans wanted her dead.
Yes, I don't know what to make of those allegations on her part, and she has not provided any evidence besides, you know, quoting an insurgent, which isn't exactly the best source on this. So she's not provided evidence. I think we have to take that allegation with a grain of salt, frankly.
Well, and as we said, the Bush administration says that it would be absurd. But what are they saying about the checkpoints? Today's Washington Post quotes a source saying that this was an impromptu checkpoint that had been set up about an hour before the shooting. It may not have been even a normal checkpoint.
Right. I don't know about that, but I do know that it is practice from time to time for the Americans in Iraq to set up impromptu checkpoints, depending on, you know, operations on the ground. They've got a particular warning in a certain area or a road they need to secure for a certain reason. It's not unusual for impromptu checkpoints to come up. And those are especially dangerous because even if you are, you know, driving with all caution and know where to expect checkpoints and know to slow down, if there's one that you're not expecting, then obviously there can be a tragic misunderstanding. And
there have been others. In fact, today the Bulgarian defense minister said that a Bulgarian soldier killed in Iraq last week was likely shot in similar circumstances, a car incident, by U.S. forces. You've reported from Iraq. What are these checkpoints like, especially on that road to Baghdad airport?
Exactly. The exact rules of engagement are a little unclear, certainly to us, to civilians, but there have been numerous incidents of civilians coming under fire mistakenly, of civilians getting killed in a few incidents on that road.
Because there's a huge threat of car bombs. There's problems with communication, with language. We've heard these stories before. It's a pretty intense situation.
Yes, definitely. It's another of Screna's accounts was that they were at one point, as they were driving out, evading puddles. So I imagined in my mind, well, perhaps someone saw that as a suspicious, evasive mood. So it is such a precarious, perilous situation there that anything can happen.
How has all of this impacted the government of Prime Minister Berlusconi, especially with regional elections to be held in a month that are thought to set the stage for national elections next year?
Right. Now, Berlusconi is going to have to handle this one quite carefully. The political opposition is eager to use this. And at the same time, Berlusconi is in this position where his ally, the United States, is going to have to come forward with a very reasonable, credible explanation, or he's in further trouble. So it's a very, very delicate situation for him.
Tracy Wilkinson, Rome Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from Rome. Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
In Israel, two rabbis have issued a religious edict ordering Jews to fast from sunrise to sunset on March 17th in an effort to stop government plans to shut down all 21 settlements in Gaza and 4 in the West Bank. Right now, that settlement evacuation is scheduled to start as planned in 4 months, and residents are scrambling to decide what to do. Some 20 miles or so south and inside Israel proper is Kibbutz Yad Hana. It's a classic left-wing communal kibbutz, a place where most people are critical of the settler movement. But in the case of politics making strange bedfellows, Kibbutz Yad Hana has invited the families of the West Bank settlement Homesh to come and live with them. In a moment, we'll speak to a settler from Homesh, but first we're joined by Yaakov Seisel. He's director of the Kibbutz Yad Hana. And Yaakov, welcome.
Thank you.
Yaakov, tell us, what was the kibbutz movement when it first started? What was it?
It was an idyllic system that thought that everybody is equal and shares the same values, and money is not so important, and everything will be divided equally. Mm. And this thing didn't work because there were people who were working very hard, and there were people who were, a little bit of parasite or something like that.
In the beginning, it was a very romantic movement. It was closely linked to the birth of Israel herself. And there was no private property. Children were raised together, sometimes separately from parents?
Yes. The children were raised in a special kindergarten. They were also sleeping in this kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And they went in the evening to say goodbye to the parents, and then they slept together.
It was
This system also caused a lot of problems. We know now in Israel that these people who were raised in this system suffer quite a lot.
Well, but it was initially idyllic. It was a commune. It was communist in nature. And yours was one of the most of this nature.
Yes. You're right. Yad Hana was a communist kibbutz, the only one in Israel.
Right. Well, how is that dream doing? How is the dream of this idyllic, romantic, communal life, everybody working in the farms together? I've had friends who went to work in kibbutz. How's it doing now?
Well, it's not working anymore. It's most of the people are working outside of the kibbutz because they couldn't earn enough money in the kibbutz. So the system of equal salary is not anymore alive, and everybody is earning his own salary, and it's only a place of, coming and living at night.
Right. Because people need the money to raise families and taking jobs in town as opposed to working avocado groves. But do you still have the avocado groves?
We still have the avocado groves, but it's not managed anymore by the kibbutz. It's managed by a big firm. Mm.
Well, and that brings us to the turn in the story. Your kibbutz recently invited a delegation from a settlement, a West Bank settlement called Homesh, to come and see your kibbutz, which is inside the borders of Israel. What was your thinking?
Well, the thinking was that that's an opportunity for Yad Hana to solve the economic crisis and to solve the pension problem, that the people in the kibbutz don't have any pension for retired, and they don't have property, and they don't have houses. So we thought it's a win-win situation. It's also good for the Homesh settlements and also for the government of Israel to solve the problem, and also for Yad Hana to solve her problem, its problem.
You think it's a win-win-win. The settlers will bring in some money. The government might give you some money. But I'm wondering, so it will no longer be a kibbutz. What will it be?
It will no longer be a kibbutz. We tried to change our our name to a moshav, you know, to do a change. We don't want to live anymore in the kibbutz.
It'll be more of a town.
Not town, but what we call moshav, what a village.
A village. Well, we understand that some of the kibbutz members met to discuss this idea of yours, and not everyone thought it was a good one. We spoke to a charming woman, Nita Fehler. She's lived on the kibbutz since 1938 when she came from Poland. She describes herself as left of left. She thinks having 30 right-wing settler families is a bad idea. For one thing, she says very directly, she thinks settlers are harming Israel's national interest.
Although some people were frightened that the new ideology people will come to the kibbutz, atmosphere of this meeting was willing to continue the negotiation between us and the people of Humash. If we summarize this meeting, I think they back us to continue to move forward for this move.
Well, what will you do to make these two groups knit as a village? On the one hand, the kibbutz members...
I want to explain you something. Listen, the kibbutz members were against the occupation of the West Bank, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they were against the settlers. And now they have an opportunity, and they can open their arms and bring them back to Israel.
In other words, they may be furthering their own politics by bringing the settlers into the kibbutz and out of the territories, which is what they've wanted.
Yes.
But what happens?
Well, there is an opportunity. They cannot say, we don't like the settlements and we don't like the occupation territories. And now, that when the settlements are ready to come back, and there are people who are settlers and they're ready to come back, then we say, okay, we close the kibbutz. It's not for them.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you finally, there seems some sort of symmetry here. Both the kibbutz and the settler movement were seen as idealistic, if on opposite sides of a political spectrum. Do you think that both of the dreams are dying? And maybe in bringing the settlers to the kibbutz, there's a new dream to be forged.
Exactly. You said that you summarized it. It's exactly. The kibbutz is no more kibbutz, and the settlements are no more settlements. For both, I think, for both sides, it's a chance to rebuild the new society. And, well, listen, they are not enemies. They are Jewish people living in Israel. And, you know, the daily life is not, you know, politician talking. Everybody is trying to make his living and to raise the kids and to give good education. That's life. We're not talking everyday life is not politics, and therefore I think there is a good chance to bridge the gap and to do the right move now.
And to survive.
Survive. That's it.
Yaakov Seisel is director of Kibbutz Yad Hana in Israel. Yaakov, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
But can two sides of the ideological spectrum live side by side? Just ahead, we'll hear from a settler from Homesh and see what she has to say about Yaakov Seisel's offer. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The dream of the Israeli settlers living in the Palestinian territories is to expand Israeli proper to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The left-leaning kibbutzes in Israeli proper think the settler movement endangers Israel, so they are unlikely allies. But we just spoke with Yaakov Seisel, the director of the left-leaning kibbutz Yad Hana, which was founded on the shared property principles of communism. He's invited the residents of a right-wing West Bank settlement called Homesh to move to the kibbutz when the settlement is closed down in 4 months, and leaders of the settlement recently visited to see for themselves. Well, one of the Homesh settlers is Eddie Rosenblatt. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, too. Thank you for letting me the opportunity to express ourselves.
Tell us about the settlement Homesh. You're in the north of the West Bank. What does it look like?
First of all, it's like a little village, no farms. We have 54 families and something about 200 or 250 members.
How do people make a living in the settlement?
Like us, like normal people, everybody has his own job.
Are there Arab villages nearby? Do you interact?
Yes.
with the Palestinians?
Yes, we have five villages, five Arab villages, and most of them, we know a lot of people from there because we used to work together, to live together. They were coming to our houses, we went to their houses.
Are you interacting now?
A little less, because we are afraid that something will happen to them, you know. Terrorists will take their children or let them a lot of money to ask them to make terror things.
Well, and now you and the rest of the members of the settlement are being asked to move. Are you going to move willingly?
Listen, nobody can move willingly. But we won't fight against it because we are a law people. We are normal citizens, and we cannot go against the government.
Well, and now leaders of the settlement are considering plans to move, including the kibbutz Yad Hana, which, as we said earlier, is a left-leaning commune in Israel proper, which has invited members of your settlement to move there. What do you think about that?
Listen to me. Just to explain the differences between settlement that we live or in the kibbutz, there is nothing that connects the members in Chomesh to the members in Yad Hana. We went together to high school with Yad Hana and us, and we have different ideas.
Members of the kibbutz, Yad Hana, are saying maybe settlers could help us out because they have cash. And we don't, but we have a place for them to live.
Listen to me. First of all, we don't know how much cash we will get. And with the cash that we will get, we have to build new houses and new lives.
What about the difference in the politics? The kibbutz movement has been against the settlements, saying settlers are harmful to Israeli national security. Do you disagree?
Of course. Because my settlement or my place that I live, my place is a strategic place because we sit only 25 kilometers by air to Netanya and to my own old village that I was born and came from.
So you feel you are protecting the flank of Israel, if you will.
That's the first argument. If we won't be there anymore, the terrorists will get to Netanya. Or to Hadera, or to Tel Aviv, or to Afula, or to Beit She'an.
And yet you have to leave. You have to move, and you say you won't disobey the law. So you have this invitation from Kibbutz Homesh. Your husband went to visit. What did you think?
They went to Yad Hana, to Bachan. It's also kibbutz near Yad Hana. And they went to Shar Ephraim and Chorshim and Tzor Yitzhak.
What did they think?
They want us. Everybody wants us.
But what does your leadership want?
Listen to me. We haven't decided yet, really. We haven't decided yet because, you know, it is so hard to decide in 3 or 4 months to change all your life.
Do you think there's any way that you, a settler, could live with a kibbutznik?
I don't see any way why not, if they will change their life to a normal place to live in.
So if the kibbutz members had private land, changed their way of life, had a different kind of economy, it might work for you.
Maybe, yes, maybe.
Yeah.
We don't want to be the pilot, you know. We are not. You are not that young to be a pilot.
The test trial. Well,
yeah.
But Eddie Rosenblatt, what will you do? You only have a few months. Where else will you go?
Really? I don't know. I really don't know. We are living like a mess now, you know. We don't sleep at night normally, and it's not that easy. Yeah. And we have a lot of friends because we are the membership, we are the leadership of the village or the place we live, and all the people are trying to get to us, and it's not that easy.
Will you try to move as a group? Will you try to stay together?
Yes. It's more comfortable. We know each other already, and we can help one another. Yes, we'll try to go as a group.
Will you go to one of the other West Bank settlements that will remain?
No, not anymore, because if one of the settlers will go away, all of it will go.
You don't trust that those settlements will stay.
That's right. And I cannot pass it away another time anymore.
If you knew that your moving and the settlements being moved would bring peace to the region,
have any doubts, you know? I'm sorry that I'm begging into you, but we know history already. We know how many problems there is. And really, you know, we have a broken heart.
Eddie Rosenblatt lives in the West Bank settlement of Homesh, scheduled to close in 4 months as part of the government plan. Eddie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, Bill Gates recently called many of the U.S. public high schools obsolete. So how would he fix them? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The United Nations is warning countries hit by December's devastating earthquake and tsunami in South Asia to be prudent when using wood to rebuild the thousands of homes, bridges, and piers that were destroyed. The UN fears that certain areas will be over-harvested as the region rebuilds. The UN is also estimating that unemployment in Aceh province in Indonesia will soar above 30%. The tsunami killed an estimated 200,000 people there and destroyed the livelihoods of many who survived. Dan Curran is director of the Humanitarian Leadership Program at Harvard Business School. Curran's just returned from Aceh province, where he was working on behalf of Mercy Corps. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Let me ask you, first of all, Dan, tell us what you saw. Were there signs beyond the physical recovery? Were there signs of psychological recovery by the people who survived this horrible disaster?
One of the things that I noticed when I left going to Aceh was the reaction of the people that you wouldn't expect to have these powerful reactions of seeing great disaster. They were just overwhelmed by the damage and destruction, and they know that they've seen things similar to this around the world. But what I didn't realize is when I got there was that a lot of people had those reactions from flying in the air, seeing the kind of helicopter approach, I call it. And once you were on the ground and working, you had a very different view. You started to meet the people, and you got to know them. And their strength and power was amazing. I've never seen it like anywhere in the world. The ability for these people to come back, to start to rebuild their lives. And one of the most, you know, we call it psychosocial trauma, which is a big issue in these crises. One of the biggest and most powerful things that I saw were we were recovering boats that had been delivered about 2 to 3 miles inland. And we were getting these fishermen together in groups of 100 or so. And they were putting big ropes around these boats, and they were singing and hauling the boats back to the shore. And the psychological effect of that, both for the fishermen and all the people watching, was immense. They were cheering and people were laughing, and I just think there was this real image of kind of the return to the sea that was a, was a very powerful psychosocial intervention.
What struck you most about the physical damage? And from your point of view, what's the most significant aspect of what still needs to be done there?
The thing that struck me the most was just the sheer size and power of what the ocean could do. It knocked down massive buildings and swept away entire villages that were not just huts and grass. It knocked down buildings that were made of cement and brick and completely washed them away. That was powerful. In addition, one of the most surprising things, though, were the survival of these mosques all along the coast. The one surviving building in any village or any area, all everywhere, were the mosques.
Because they were so well built?
There are two ways of looking at it. For some, it was because they were well built and contractors never wanted to cheat on a mosque as far as building materials. For most of the people there, though, they saw it as a hand of God kind of message to them. As far as the recovery, the thing that's needed the most right now is we need some clarity from the Indonesian government, supported by the internationals, that allows people to return to their villages and build as quickly as possible.
I wonder if you think international attention to the ongoing recovery has waned to the point where there's not enough help from the internationals.
No, I mean, it's waned. The media crush was overwhelming in the early days. It was just a huge spotlight, but it lasted only about 2 weeks, and then it just disappeared as quickly as it came. But the fact that there's no attention doesn't mean there's not a lot of work going on. There's enormous amounts of private funding there that we've never seen the likes of before, meaning every agency has a great deal of resources to put to the recovery effort.
How does the strategy for dealing with areas hit by the tsunami different from relief efforts that come from other disasters?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, we're still kind of stuck, and the international community, is still kind of stuck in the old strategies, the strategies that we've developed over the years in conflict zones, where we have to consider how we don't engender dependence. We have to think about how we deliver aid in a way that doesn't open people to predation by the powers that be and so forth. This one, I think, is much more similar to a recovery such as the hurricane in Florida, where there is a working market, there is a functioning society, there is a strong social cohesion among the people. Therefore, we need to really work on what I call an emergent recovery, where we follow what the people are doing. We come in behind them with Mercy Corps, with our advice from Harvard, are delivering cash grants to communities right now, basically going in, doing fast-track development, asking the communities what they want, what they need, and then delivering a large bulk cash grant to them, saying, you deliver on what you think you can do, and we just want to see progress. Before I left, we did this with three villages. One in particular was called La Mujong. And when I returned to La Mujong, the day after we delivered the cash grant, they had already purchased beams and metal sheeting and were building their temporary housing. That was not supported by or delivered by any large logistical delivery mechanism, nor was it planned in some strong relief and development planning meeting. It was simply delivered, and the people did it themselves.
Give us what we tell you we need as opposed to what you think we need.
Precisely. Precisely.
Tell me how your experience in Aceh will inform what you do in your Harvard program in relation to strategy development with the leaders of major NGOs in what to do down the road when faced with similar situations. Hopefully not, but, you know, life's inevitable.
Yeah. For me, it was very powerful to get down on the ground and spend the time and the effort it takes to actually deliver relief and recovery efforts for the people. I used to do this for many years, and then I slowly filtered, as happens with many, up through the ranks of academia or up through the ranks of the organizations, and you start to work at these high levels. What I learned is that strategy needs to be developed by the people on the ground. It needs to be adaptable, and it needs to be nimble. It needs to be able to make plans with the people there. And then the organizations almost need to be flipped, where they are supporting the people on the ground, and the people on the ground are looking forward with all of the greater strength of an organization behind them.
That's Dan Curran of Harvard Business School, who's just returned from Indonesia, where he was doing relief work for Mercy Corps. Dan spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. You're listening to Here and Now. In a dramatic shakeup, Sony Corporation is appointing a Westerner to head the struggling Japanese electronics and entertainment giant. British-born Sir Howard Stringer, a former TV news journalist who's now running Sony's U.S. operations, will take over as chairman and chief executive. It is very rare for a major Japanese corporation to be headed by a foreigner. So we have more on today's surprising announcement with Here Now business reporter Mark Mills. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Robin.
And how did this all come about that Howard Stringer, a Welsh-born British knight who also holds U.S. citizenship, is now going to head one of Japan's most prestigious companies?
It's a pretty unlikely story. It's true. 63-year-old Howard Stringer was born in Wales, educated at Oxford. He was working in the U.S. as a young journalist in the 60s during Vietnam and found he was eligible for the draft. And he ended up going to Vietnam as a U.S. soldier and served with distinction. He was a CBS newsman who rose to become CBS chairman. He once produced Dan Rather's nightly newscast. He is reportedly a very charming guy, diplomatic, an excellent negotiator. He brought to CBS some big-name talent like David Letterman and also managed to get along with Lawrence Tisch, the prickly former owner of CBS. He was knighted by Queen Elizabeth in 1997, and he's been running the Sony Corporation of America here in the U.S. for Sony and led a turnaround in their music and movie divisions, including last year's acquisition of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
So what does it say about Sony these days, if you know, that it turned to someone who wasn't Japanese to run the company?
Very rare, and it's a humbling time for Sony. The company's really been outflanked by competitors in the flat-screen TV business, and it's lost major ground in the portable music area to Apple's iPod. Remember, this is the company that invented the Walkman, right, and nobody talks about that anymore.
Right.
Sony stock is down 60% since the outgoing chairman and CEO, Nobuyuki Ide, took over both those roles in 2000. The Nikkei average for Japan is down 30% in that time, but still the company's down much more. And the company really needs to sharpen its focus and cut costs. In a controversial speech to Sony executives in January, Stringer said, "The business of Sony has become management, not product design." So the Japanese penchant for bureaucracy seems to be one area where Stringer will have to sharpen the axe and test his skills as a consensus builder.
And is he seen as the guy who can do it, you know, to cost cut?
Well, you know, it's a challenge because he's mostly been in entertainment in his career, and Sony still gets about 70% of its revenue from electronics. But he did oversee cost-cutting at CBS in the 80s, cut a couple of hundred jobs in the news division. He's overseen.
I remember that.
Okay.
I just want to say I remember that.
That doesn't hit close to home, does it?
I'm
sorry.
But go on.
All right. Also, a lot of Sony jobs have been cut in recent years that he's been overseeing. So he's done the turnaround drill, and he will be doing it again. There's some speculation that he may consider spinning off the entertainment divisions of Sony, which have been doing better than the electronics business. But one quote from Stringer today might indicate otherwise. He said, "We look forward to joining our twin pillars of engineering and technology with our commanding presence in entertainment and content creation to deliver the most advanced devices and forms of entertainment to the consumer."
Well, what has the market reaction been to statements such as that?
Well,
and the news?
So far, this is playing well. In Japan, Sony shares were up 1.5%, and so far in midday trading in the U.S., Sony stock also up about 1.5%.
Yeah, well, we can't let you go, Mark, without asking about the other big
news. Oh, don't
news
tell me
today.
There's another story in the news.
There is. Martha Stewart had cappuccino, apparently. she's now sporting an electronic ankle bracelet back at her home. She went to work at Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia in New York and returns to a company in much worse shape than when she was convicted. What are the prospects for Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia?
not as bright as you'd think they are for Martha herself right now, Robin. Last week, the company reported a quarterly loss of $7.3 million compared to a profit of $2.4 million in the same quarter a year ago. They're seeing declining revenue for ads in their publications, and, of course, her TV show was sidelined during her jailing. The company stock more than tripled from the time of Martha's conviction to when she got out of jail, but in just the last 2 days of trading, Friday and so far today, the stock is down 18% from where it closed last Thursday night. So there was a lot of speculation on driving the price up, but the reality of it is it's come down. And this is a company that really had the peak of its fortunes back in 2001. That's when its earnings peaked. So it's been on a slide since well before her stock troubles, and there's a real question as to whether the company will make the kind of comeback that Martha seems to be making with all of the blitz that she's had and the TV shows that she has coming up.
Well, as we said with an analyst last week, do not count her or her cappuccino or her company out.
I guess that's probably a good guess to make.
Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Mark Mills, Here and Now's business reporter. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In news today that we're following, Syrian military vehicles loaded with furniture and personnel were seen heading east towards the Lebanese mountains and the Syrian border. This is the first sign that Syrian troops may eventually withdraw from Lebanon, a country they've been in for 29 years. The presidents of both Syria and Lebanon announced that Syria's troops will be pulled back to the border in two stages over the next few months. Both governments said they will agree to a complete withdrawal but didn't offer a specific timetable. The Syrian ambassador to the U.S. told CNN, "We entered Lebanon to end a bloody civil war. Now we are withdrawing in compliance with international law. We are giving a good example to the rest of the Middle East." In the aftermath of the assassination of the former Lebanese prime minister, the United States, France, Russia, and other nations asked Syria to remove all its forces from Lebanon. Meanwhile, in Beirut, more than 30,000 protesters chanted "Syria out" at a demonstration today. Many waved their country's flag. One banner read, "Today we have one target, to liberate our land." Tomorrow, Lebanon's Shiite Muslim militant group Hezbollah will also hold a demonstration. We'll have more as that story develops on tomorrow's program. The National Endowment for the Arts says only 3% of books published in the U.S. are translations. But the internet literary magazine Words Without Borders is trying to change that. Funded through grants and donations, the online webzine translates writers who may be known in their own countries but whose works have not been available in English. Elaine Mason, founding editor of Words Without Borders, spoke recently with Here Now's Bill Marks about the webzine's genesis.
Well, after about 15 years in publishing, I became more and more aware that part of the reason I fell in love with reading had to do with exposure to literature and translation. And most of us don't even realize how much of our reading from an early age is literature and translation, starting with the Bible and Grimm's fairy tales and Hans Christian Andersen and Pinocchio and Greek and Norse myths. And in fact, I was deeply disappointed in college when I realized that studying English meant actually that I was only going to study English and American literature. I somehow thought that English should be everything available in English, including literature and translation, and that in fact across the publishing industry, literature and translation was on the wane. Most younger editors don't speak foreign languages, and the economics of publishing made it harder and harder to make the investment of time and energy into publishing literature and translation.
Is that why you decided to place this site on the internet rather than try to open your own small publishing house dealing with the works in translation?
Yes, absolutely. And I wanted to be able to take the kinds of risks that it's very hard to take when you're making the investment in publishing a book. And so I wanted to open up a space where editors like me could read new writers in translation and then maybe take a chance on one of them.
Now, what countries do you draw on in terms of the literature that you've posted on Words Without Borders? I mean, have you literally gone all around the world, or are there certain specific areas?
I think we have done a pretty good job of going all around the world. We began with Iran, Iraq, and North Korea because our launch theme was literature from the axis of evil. It expressed the mission of the site, which is that we need to know what other people are, rather than simply labeling other cultures as evil or friendly. We need to actually know what their cultures are about. And obviously we can't know just through a handful of writers, but it's better, you know, a little knowledge. I actually think a little knowledge is better than none.
Well, you brought a sample of some writing with you that was recently posted on your website. Could you tell me a little bit about it and read from it?
Sure. Najem Wali is an Iraqi writer who we did actually publish in one of our very first features. He's an Iraqi writer in exile living in Hamburg for the last 20 years. And his writing is very international and quite charming, I think. So I'll just read a brief excerpt translated from the Arabic by Jennifer Kaplan. I still remember him like it was yesterday, a small man, elegant in his own special way. He used to buy his clothes from secondhand shops, lenga, as we used to call them. He would choose them with a care and taste for beauty. In winter, he would wrap a long red scarf around his neck. Then, on days when the cold was harshest, he would wear a black leather jacket. I can remember its design perfectly, just as I remember the khaki raincoat that resembled Humphrey Bogart's famous raincoat in Casablanca, which he used to wear on Basra's rare rainy days. Edward, with the curly hair and sparkling eyes, owner of a small bookshop in Al-Ashar. He didn't sell newspapers or literary works. He made do with comic books and car and sailboat magazines and medical books written in English.
So it does indicate how sort of our culture, popular culture, you know, Casablanca, Humphrey Bogart, in a sense, is infusing itself into international fiction.
Exactly. Another one of Wally's stories pays homage to Tom Waits. And at a time that, you know, Iraq was still part of the axis of evil, it was illuminating to me to realize that people living in Basra were listening to Tom Waits.
Do you find that to be, I mean, an opportunity? Or when people read foreign fiction, they expect, in a sense, to encounter a foreign culture. And now, particularly in this example and others that you mentioned, I mean, we're, in a sense, reading literature from a foreign culture and encountering ourselves through the perceptions of that culture.
And seeing ourselves in the mirror, so to speak. But I think that's illuminating on its own. And also, I think there's a kind of thrill in it, in the same way that when you make friends with somebody from a foreign culture, it's the mix of the things that you have in common and the things that are completely different that makes that relationship so exciting.
Now, what are the challenges in terms of putting up a site like this?
Well, certainly finding the good stuff is always a challenge, particularly from parts of the world with which we have less contact. I mean, certainly finding French and German and Italian material is not difficult at all. But we set ourselves a tall order from the beginning in trying to find material from countries where we didn't have necessarily the same cultural interchange. For instance, trying to find material from North Korea to fill out our Axis of Evil theme was incredibly difficult. And the only literature we were able to find was propaganda. Then we had the decision, do we publish this stuff or not? And we decided that actually it was significant and illuminating in its own right to discover that this is what North Korean writers were writing and this was what all that we could find from North Korea. It actually made North Korea seem a much scarier place than either Iraq or Iran, where we were able to find lots of writers of diverse points of view.
Since you're the editor, I'm going to take an opportunity to ask about who are some of the people that appeared on your site that have really excited you as writers? I mean, who are some of the hot writers you've had there?
I happen to love a writer named Chirdad Zolgadar, who's an Iranian writer living in Zurich, who writes about a Tehran which is totally different from any Tehran I've read about anywhere else. A Tehran that sort of resembles Soho, of art galleries and people doing drugs and nonetheless mullahs walking around, and a very surreal portrait. I also loved the section that I read of Ernesto Sabato's memoir. He's a great Argentinian writer whose work I think is either not translated at all here, or what has been translated I think is more or less out of print.
Yeah.
And he was a candidate for the Nobel Prize many years running. That's a beautiful piece.
You've given us lots of things that we can read. Thank you so much, Elaine Mason, editor of Words Without Borders.
Here now is Bill Marks speaking with Elaine Mason, editor of Word Without Borders. For more information and a link to the online webzine for international literature, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Deborah Becker. Our interns, Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.